Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 4th of March, these are our main stories. A disgraced US lawyer, Alex Murdoch, is given life for killing his wife and son in a saga of fraud, drug addiction and abuse of power. The head of Russia's Wagner Group claims his forces have nearly surrounded the Ukrainian town of Bakhmut. Pressure mounts on the former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson over whether he lied about COVID lockdown parties. Also in this podcast...
At £33 million. Sold. Many congratulations, Oliver. Thank you. Thank you very much.
A Kandinsky painting that was stolen by the Nazis fetches a record price at auction. It's the case that has gripped the US and drawn attention from all over the world. Now, a once powerful lawyer from South Carolina, Alex Murdoch, has been given two life sentences for the murder of his wife and son. The case has been filled with drama right until its conclusion. Here, in his closing remarks, the prosecutor, Creighton Waters, described what it was like seeing the defendant each day during the proceedings.
No one who thought they were close to this man knew who he really was. And, Your Honor, that's chilling. And I've looked in his eyes, and he liked to stare me down as he would walk by me during this trial. And I could see the real Alex Murdoch when he looked at me. The depravity, the callousness, the selfishness of these crimes are stunning. The lack of remorse and the effortless way in which he lies, including here sitting right over there in this witness stand. Your Honor, a man like that, a man like this man, should never be allowed to be among free law-abiding citizens again.
Murdoch was part of a legal dynasty that stretched back decades, who'd given out death sentences for lesser offences than his, often against African Americans. Sentencing him, the judge, Clifton Newman, described the trial as one of the most troubling cases he'd ever presided over.
A lawyer, a person from a respected family who has controlled justice in this community for over a century, a person whose grandfather's portrait hung at the back of the courthouse that I had to have ordered removed in order to ensure that a fair trial was had by both the state and the defense.
When it came to the defense lawyer's final remarks, he handed over to the accused, Alex Murdoch himself.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm innocent. I would never hurt my wife, Maggie, and I would never hurt my son, Pawpaw.
Well, much credit is being given to the investigative journalism of Mandy Matney and Liz Farrell. Their Murdoch Murders podcast challenged the official investigation in a community where the Murdoch family was supremely powerful. Liz Farrell spoke to my colleague, Anita Anand.
This isn't your normal murder trial. This is much, much bigger. It is about corruption. It is about a family that throughout history, generations in this area of South Carolina, they were the law and they were able to get away with, I guess, whatever they got into is really the saying. So it's called Murdoch Country, where I live here and where Mandy and I have been reporting from. And this was a big, big moment for South Carolina because we never thought that we would see it get this far. And I just give great credit to everyone here who just worked so hard to make this happen, because the Murdochs are a powerful force here.
Now, at first, Alex Murdoch presented himself as the grieving father, and he claimed all sorts of alternative theories as to who shot his wife and his son at close range. What were some of the things that were flying around?
Well, you have to understand with Alex Murdoch, he grew up knowing exactly who he was in the state and knowing that whatever he said was true was something that everyone had to believe was true. So his theories weren't that elaborate. They weren't that well thought out. He blamed it on, at first, the boat crash victims. There was a 2019 boat crash here in which a young woman named Mallory Beach was killed. And he blamed it as retribution for that because his son was driving the boat and was facing three felony charges at the time of his murder. So that's one of the major theories. Mm. The other theories were very loose as well, but he never had anything specific.
Okay.
Nothing specific.
But I mean, you sort of seem to suggest that that might have, in a different era, been enough if you had the name Murdoch. It clearly wasn't this time around. What was the motivation for these killings?
I believe the motivation is shifting, I would say. It's a lot of things. He stole more than $8 million from his law firm and from clients. And on top of that, he had a decade-long scheme going on. And it was about to be found out because of the civil case in the boat crash. So Mallory Beach's family was suing him, and they hired a very tenacious attorney to represent them. And he went hard. He was asking to look at his finances, and Ellick was claiming to be broke, and they just knew that simply couldn't be true. And so he was basically days away from having to hand over a list of his bank accounts. And had they got that, they would have seen that he had been stealing for years.
Okay. So, I mean, is this as mundane as just to sort of change the narrative by, you know, doing something as brutal as slaying your family so people feel sorry for you and talk about something else?
Well, feel sorry is one thing. And I think there's great evidence of that. There was a lot of sympathy that he benefited from. But I also think he was eliminating a problem. And I also think that he was a family annihilator, which is he could no longer provide for his family. These were two dependents. Maggie didn't work and Paul didn't work. And he provided them a good life. And Moselle, the hunting property where they were killed, was a paradise for Paul. It was his greatest love. And I think that Ellick knew that he might lose it someday.
There's been an explosion of successful crime casts of late, if we can put it that way. You know, The Teacher's Pet, Serial, S-Town. And they're credited with sort of pushing along investigations. What role do you think you played in getting to this verdict?
I honestly don't think we would have gotten this far with the state investigating him. I think it would be much easier for the state not to have investigated Ellick Murdoch. It would have been much easier for them if it was someone else. So I think they needed all eyes on them. I think they needed accountability. I think they needed to have no other answer than we need to do our job to the fullest extent. And they did it. They did their job to the fullest extent.
Investigative journalist Liz Farrell. It's been the focus of some of the most intense fighting in Ukraine for months as Ukrainian forces try to hold out against Russia's push to take the eastern town of Bakhmut. Now the Russian mercenary group Wagner says the town is surrounded with only one exit route. Wagner's leader Yevgeny Prigozhin has issued a video which he says was filmed in Bakhmut, calling on Ukraine to withdraw from there as its soldiers want to leave.
I appeal to the President of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky. Wagner units have almost surrounded Bakhmut. There's only one road left. If earlier we were fighting the professional Ukrainian army, today we see more and more old people and children. They fight, but their life in Bakhmut is very short, 1 to 2 days. Let them leave the city.
But the video is being treated with scepticism. We got an assessment from Victoria Zuhan from the BBC Ukrainian service in Kyiv.
Prigozhin, that we can identify, is standing on the top of the roof with a village or a town behind. So BBC News Ukrainian correspondents that are familiar with that area say that it is definitely not Bakhmut. Then Ukrainian armed forces have issued a statement that they recognize it as a village of Paraskovyevka that Russia has claimed to have taken a few days ago. We haven't been able to confirm yet that it was Paraskovyevka, but it's definitely not Bakhmut. Then the camera pans to three men that are dressed in clothing and in the uniform of the armed forces of Ukraine. But they do not have any identification signs on the uniform. So usually in Ukraine, they have to be wearing signs that say their name and the unit they belong to. In this video, we cannot see any of that. So we are not able to verify their identities or their units. So the only thing we actually see is the uniform of the armed forces of Ukraine. And finally, these three men are filmed talking on this video. But as the camera pans to them, the wind is very, very loud. So as they speak Russian, I'm from Ukraine. I wasn't able to identify the accent. Could it be an accent in Russian language of a Russian speaker, or is it an accent from a Ukrainian speaker that speaks Russian in Ukraine? And of course, they didn't speak Ukrainian. So, summarizing all this, it's really fair to question whether those three men are prisoners of war, or maybe they were just Ukrainian locals, again, captivated by Prigozhin and his mercenaries.
Victoria Zhuhan in Ukraine. Well, as the war there rages on, there's growing concern about neighbouring Moldova's breakaway region of Transnistria, where Russia has military forces stationed. The territory separated from Moldova in a civil war in 1992 as the country emerged from Soviet rule. Now there are fears that the conflict in Ukraine could spill over into Moldova, whose pro-Western government has spoken of the need to remove Russian troops from Transnistria. Lucy Williamson has been speaking to Moldovan veterans in Molovata Noa, a Moldovan enclave wedged beside Transnistrian territory.
The dirt road into Moldova's breakaway pro-Russian region is deserted, except for the convoy of cars carrying men in military fatigues from the village of Molovata Noa. Men now in their 50s and 60s, crossing into enemy territory as they did 30 years ago when they fought pro-Russian forces for control of this area. Once a year, these veterans make a pilgrimage from the Moldovan village of Molovata Noa into Russian-controlled Transnistria, following a trail of simple monuments, pale blue crosses made from metal poles that mark the places their comrades fell, sharing wine from a plastic bottle and remembering young men like Vasya.
I was coming down this road with Vasya. We are both snipers. He was hit in the neck with a shrapnel fragment. He fell to the ground and died in my arms.
But memories of the past here are now joined by fears for the future. Moscow has been talking up the threat of a Ukrainian assault on Transnistria, warning that any attack on its forces there will be seen as an attack on Russia itself. Moldova's president has warned of a Russian plot to topple her pro-Western government. As the veterans pass a local school, the pupils come out with head teacher Tatiana Roska to greet them. There were big battles here in 1992 that left deep wounds, she says. We're very afraid. We know what war means, and we don't wish it on anyone. One of her pupils tells me she's ready to take up arms, as her father and grandfather did here 30 years ago. But the pull of Moldovan identity is set against the pull of subsidized Russian gas from Transnistria. There are those here who say that Transnistria looks after them, while Moldova's government, on the other side of the River Dniester, ignores them, and that President Maia Sandu is provoking a war with Moscow by moving closer to the West.
I'm going to be honest. It's very difficult to convince people that life is better in Moldova when they pay a fraction of the price for gas here.
The mayor of Molovata Noa, Oleg Gazia, says divisions here have deepened since Moscow cut gas supplies to Moldova last year.
We can't talk about freedom and a better life and at the same time tell them to go across the river and pay 30 times more for their bills. They'll say, "Are you crazy?" But there's a hidden price. It buys their support.
In the village square, the veterans end their pilgrimage by laying red carnations at a memorial to the frozen conflict. In the years since they fought pro-Russian forces, their children have grown up alongside Russian soldiers, Russian language, and Russian economic support. We older men will still form the heart of any resistance, Vlad tells me, even with the involvement of younger men.
That report was by Lucy Williamson. The White House says President Biden had a cancerous lesion removed from his chest last month. His doctor says that all the cancerous tissue was successfully removed and no further treatment is required. Our Washington correspondent, Nomia Iqbal, has more details.
When the president had his regular physical checkup last month, his doctor Kevin O'Connor noted that a small lesion on Mr. Biden's chest had been removed. He was then sent for a biopsy the same day. The results now confirm that it was basal cell cancer, which does not tend to spread as other more serious skin cancers do. Dr. Connor said it's healed well, and the 80-year-old president will continue to be under skin surveillance as part of his ongoing health care. In January, the First Lady, Jill Biden, had three skin lesions, some cancerous, but they were removed.
Nomia Iqbal. The South African Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius, who was jailed in 2014 for the murder of his girlfriend, is to attend a parole hearing at the end of this month. Pistorius, who was known as the Blade Runner because of his carbon fibre prosthetics, has served half of his 15-year sentence. Andrew Harding reports from Johannesburg.
It's just over a decade since Oscar Pistorius fired shots at his bathroom door late at night, killing his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp. Throughout his long televised trial, the Paralympic athlete insisted he thought he was shooting at an intruder.
And then I heard a noise from inside the toilet. Before I knew it, I'd fired four shots at the door. She wasn't breathing.
But an appeal court eventually ruled that he must have intended to kill someone, and so a manslaughter conviction was changed to murder. Having served half his sentence, Pistorius is now eligible for parole. His case will be heard at the end of this month. As part of South Africa's restorative justice programme, Pistorius met Reva Steenkamp's father last year. But the Steenkamps continue to insist Pistorius killed their daughter deliberately and say they oppose parole. Pistorius is now 36 years old and is being held at a small prison outside the city of Pretoria.
Andrew Harding in South Africa. A UN report says gang-related violence in Haiti has reached levels not seen in decades. In a new assessment, the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime says there's been a surge in the number of weapons smuggled into the Caribbean nation. A dire economic crisis has worsened since the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse nearly 2 years ago. Here's Bethany Bell.
The UNODC report says Haiti is in the grip of multiple crises, with the security situation in the country deteriorating rapidly. It says increasingly sophisticated and high-caliber firearms and ammunition are being trafficked into Haiti. The UNODC also reports a rise in homicide, sexual violence and kidnappings. And it says that violent gangs have effectively seized control of large swathes of the country, compounding the severity of a cholera outbreak, increasing food insecurity and displacing thousands of people.
Bethany Bell. Still to come on this podcast.
A charity worker removes the lid on a shallow, rusty box. Inside are four puppies, which they've rescued from illegal breeders in Hungary.
A BBC investigation has uncovered a dog smuggling network across Europe. Here in London, another twist in a long-running saga. A British parliamentary committee has said that the former Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, may have misled the House of Commons over parties held at his official residence, 10 Downing Street, during the pandemic when much of the country was under lockdown. Mr. Johnson, who's due to be questioned by the committee later this month, gave this response to the report.
I didn't mislead the House, and I believed that what we were doing was within the rules. That's why I said what I said to Parliament. And I think what's so interesting about the report today is that after 10 months of effort, they found absolutely no evidence to suggest otherwise.
Our political correspondent, Rob Watson, told us what this could mean for the former British Prime Minister.
It is immensely serious. I mean, it could even end his career, at least temporarily, as an MP, because if this committee finds that he did mislead Parliament intentionally and recklessly, it's possible that he could be suspended or even have to fight a sort of a mini-election. And one has to say that listening there just to Boris Johnson saying that the committee has so far cleared him, the absolute opposite is true. It's as if he'd read a different report. I mean, it's quite clear from reading the interim report from these MPs that they actually think there are very strong grounds, and there is evidence to think that he deliberately misled Parliament on multiple times, and it could not, Jadak, get much more serious than that.
So there'll be a lot at stake for him when he sits down to face questions from this committee later this month.
There will. And it's important to remember, no one's disputing that there were these kind of alcohol-fuelled parties in Downing Street during lockdown. That's not the bit that's in dispute. I mean, the police found that. They fined 83 people, including Boris Johnson, and an earlier report also found that there was widespread rule-breaking. That's not the issue. The issue is, did he mislead Parliament when he said, look, I've been advised that all the rules were followed? So that's what they're going to be focusing on when he appears before the committee on the 30th of March. And by the sound of things and reading through the interim report, it's going to be a pretty feisty exchange. And Mr. Johnson, I think, is going to have trouble defending himself, because it's not just his word against whatever the committee ask him. The committee has the evidence in form of WhatsApp messages, email messages, and it's also interviewed those members of Mr. Johnson's staff who helped to prepare him for those interviews, of those statements that he gave to Parliament. So potentially an explosive session in a couple of weeks' time.
And briefly, what's the public perception of this? Because a lot of people have said that this has contributed to the eroding of trust in politicians.
Well, briefly, I think the public had already made up their minds that a large chunk of them are incredibly disappointed by Boris Johnson's behaviour and the breaking down of lockdown rules. There's another significant minority who take the view, oh, well, Boris did the best he could.
Rob Watson. A woman in Belgium who murdered her 5 children has been killed at her own request. Genevieve Lemiet's lawyer said that his client had chosen to die on the 16th anniversary of the crime. From Belgium, here's Jessica Parker.
It was a case that shocked the country. In 2007, while the children's father was away, Genevieve Lemiet murdered her son and 4 daughters in Nivelles, an area south of Brussels. She then tried and failed to take her own life and ended up calling the emergency services. She was sentenced to life in prison before being moved to a psychiatric hospital in 2019. Now aged 56, it's emerged that Genevieve Lemiet died earlier this week, exactly 16 years on from the crime. Belgian law allows people to choose to be euthanized under certain circumstances, including if they're in a condition of constant and unbearable suffering, either mental or physical, that cannot be alleviated. The authorities say nearly 3,000 people died through euthanasia in Belgium last year, with cancer the most common reason.
Jessica Parker. A BBC investigation has uncovered a dog smuggling network across Europe and the squalid conditions in which the animals are kept. Hundreds of dogs are being brought illegally from sites in Eastern Europe into the UK, which is one of the biggest markets for puppies. The demand for new pets across the continent has risen sharply since the COVID lockdowns. Our reporter Anna Adams infiltrated online groups who are buying and selling puppies.
A charity worker removes the lid on a shallow, rusty box. Inside are 4 puppies, which they've rescued from illegal breeders in Hungary. A BBC Our World investigation found smugglers breaking the law and abusing the pet passport scheme to traffic pregnant dogs and puppies into the UK. They make their way to the UK on land via Germany, where police have seized more than 3,000 dogs since 2021. The BBC learned about one case where a Hungarian national tried to bring 4 heavily pregnant dachshunds into the UK in squalid conditions, claiming they were his pets. We spoke to staff who'd rescued the dogs at the animal shelter, but they asked us not to use their names.
The boxes were far too small, very dirty and full of urine.
At the animal shelter, they gave birth to 21 puppies, worth more than £42,000.
They weren't used to any contact with people. They didn't know any sounds, and the outside was also alien to them. The first time we put them on the meadow, they were completely overwhelmed. They didn't know what to do.
The smuggler was released without charge in Germany. A few days later, he was caught by British border authorities as he tried to smuggle more dogs into the UK. But he was released again without charge. We tried to contact him, but he didn't respond. The BBC infiltrated a network of online groups buying and selling pregnant dogs. In the UK, it's illegal to sell puppies that you haven't bred yourself. Back in Hungary, we meet Adina, who's rescued hundreds of dogs from puppy mills. She says breeders will go to extreme lengths to hide the dogs.
She's a rescue from a puppy mill in Karczag where there are nearly 150 dogs. The adults had their vocal cords cut so that they couldn't bark and draw attention from the neighbours.
As long as the UK's appetite for puppies continues, experts say smugglers will persist. They say the only way to stop them is to refuse to buy a dog unless you are sure of where it's come from.
Anna Adams reporting. A masterpiece by Vasily Kandinsky that had been stolen by the Nazis has been sold for a new record at auction in London. Rebecca Wood has the details.
It was a packed evening at Sotheby's auction house, a sea of glamorous dresses, suits and neatly coiffed hair. And on the wall, what most were there to see, an oil painting depicting the Bavarian village of Murnau in a burst of colour.
Which brings us now to the starlet of the season, one of the most important works by Vasily Kandinsky ever to appear at auction. Painted in 1910, Murnau mit Kirche II was in the collection of the Van Abbe Museum in Eindhoven, from 1951 until last year when it was restituted to the heirs of Siegbert and Johanna Margareta Stern.
The piece, which is said to have heralded the Russian master's move towards abstract art, had originally hung in the dining room of the aforementioned Jewish couple, Johanna Margareta Stern-Lippmann and Siegbert Stern. They were keen art collectors who enjoyed the Berlin cultural circle in the 1920s, counting the likes of Franz Kafka and Albert Einstein as their friends. But that was all to change when the Nazis rose to power. Siegbert died of natural causes in 1935, but Johanna was forced to flee Germany and was later murdered in Auschwitz. Their collection of more than 100 artworks was looted and dispersed across the region. This particular painting was discovered a decade ago in a museum in the Netherlands. Last year, it made it back into the hands of descendants of the Stern family, and now it's made its way to the auction house.
At £33 million, the hammer is up. At £33 million. Sold. Many congratulations, Oliver. Thank you.
A hammer price of $40 million meant a final price of nearly $45 million for the as-yet-unknown phone bidder, a record for a Kandinsky piece, say the auctioneers.
That was Rebecca Wood. Before we go, let's tell you about a new podcast that the Global News Podcast team is putting together. It's called The Happy Pod, and here to tell us all about it is Andrew Peach.
So this is an additional extra episode of the Global News Podcast. We're not changing the podcast that we make, but on Saturday lunchtime, there's an extra bonus episode we're calling The Happy Pod, as you say. And the reason we're doing it is lots of Global News Podcast listeners got in touch to say they wanted to hear a collection of the world's happy news. I think in real life, we often tell each other quite positive, happy stories, and somehow the news doesn't do that because we're very focused on geopolitics and important things that have happened. So the idea here is to try and find the happiest stories in the world and talk to the people who are at the centre of them.
Because that is a criticism that a lot of people make of news, that we focus on the negative when actually there are so many positive things happening out there.
There are things that are heartwarming, things that, as you say, are positive, that make you feel happy when you hear about them. Some of the things we have coming up in the first Happy Pod on Saturday are two dogs, two huskies who live in Finland. They're in an animal rescue centre. They're beautiful. They get on with each other, but they don't really get on with the other animals. In fact, if they got anywhere near the other animals, it would end badly. So we've been trying to find a new home for these two huskies, and we have. Also, in the Caribbean, in Dominica, a man got stuck on his sailboat and was adrift for weeks with nothing to sustain him but a bottle of ketchup. That kept him going. He still likes ketchup now. In fact, his friends have started to call him Ketchup. We'll talk to him. And also the octogenarian whose knitwear is going to win an Oscar in the next few days because she knitted the jumpers on one of the movies that he's bound to be a winner. Showbiz knitters on the Happy Pod coming up.
So those are some of the stories coming up this week, and it's going to be every week.
We're going to try it as a weekly thing. We always want to hear what our listeners have got to say. In fact, we really want people to take part in this by dropping us an email telling us about their happy news. But of course, with anything new, you never get it right at the beginning. So we really want some feedback to get an idea that this is the sort of thing, the sort of collection of happy stories that you wanted from us. And hopefully, we'll make it a weekly thing in the months to come.
because I'm sure there are many happy news stories out there. Andrew, thank you.
And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Alice Adley. It was mixed by Russell Newlove. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.